It is Tuesday, December 31st, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Katie Henriksen.
Jacqueline Froelich.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Timothy Dennis.
And this is a special edition of Ozarks at Large. As has been our custom, the last week of each year, we talk about some of our favorite stories, interviews, features that we did in the previous 12 months. And I'm betting this first favorite is a word that very few people knew. I had not heard of it until Jacqueline Froelich came into my office and said, have you heard of
derecho? All right. A journalist friend of mine from West Plains called me and said, Jackie, I'm doing a story on derecho. I'm going over to the Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma to talk with experts about them because one of these things blew the forest down, 10,000 of acres of forest in mid-south Missouri. And I just wanted to let you know I'm going to stop by and see you. And, of course, I'm going, what is a derecho? I had to look it up, and it turns out it is a wind event. It also turns out we are at ground zero for these wind events that are becoming more frequent, were novel, and are incredibly devastating.
Well, derecho is actually a Spanish term. It's a derivative of a Spanish term that means direct or straight ahead.
Derecho expert Stephen Corfitti is lead forecaster with the Storm Prediction Center based in Norman, Oklahoma, a division of the National Weather Service. He and his colleagues work round-the-clock shifts to provide severe weather warnings and watches to meteorologists and the public. The center's website, spc.noaa.gov, is a trove of information and contains an entire section dedicated to derechos. Stephen Corfitti says the word derecho was coined back in the 1880s.
By a physics professor at the University of Iowa, Dr. Gustavus Heinrichs. And he recognized at a relatively early date that there was a distinction between the cyclones or tornadoes that were playing havoc on the settlers and early farmers that were settling, moving westward from the eastern United States into the mid-Mississippi Valley, upper Mississippi Valley. And he recognized that there was a class of storms that were distinct from the tornadic storm that were also significant and produced widespread damaging winds, particularly those that would flatten crops and knock buildings down. But they weren't rotary-type storms or turning-type storms like a typical tornado.
Derechos are rare events. Only a few occur each year. And you never hear them forecast because derechos are documented as such only after they occur. And they most commonly occur from May through Labor Day.
The conditions that are most favorable for derecho development include a large mass of very warm and humid air that is experiencing a certain amount of lift. And by lift, I mean meteorological lift. And that lift can come from what you would call a cold front or a warm front or a low pressure system. And that lift preferentially has to be moving. So if the weather disturbance is moving and encountering a large swath of very warm and humid air, particularly if that air that is warm and humid at the surface is overlaying or has cooler air at the mid and upper levels of the atmosphere. In a derecho environment, the most likely setup wind-wise is to have the wind speed increasing with height and blowing from the same direction with height. So essentially what happens is you have a snowplow effect that you get a mass of air starting to move in one direction and acting as a snowplow and lifting or overturning along the cold front or low pressure system a whole swath of that very warm and humid air. And when that overturning occurs, basically we're talking about thunderstorms, that thunderstorm is able to redevelop or replicate itself in that downstream direction.
Such severe and damaging wind events often appear on radar as bow echoes. Imagine a massive green archer's bow with a bursting red center.
Kind of in a backward C-shaped or a boomerang shape, that bowing shape to the line of strong echoes is an indication, more often than not, that very strong winds are reaching the surface behind the apex of the bow. In other words, the bow is bulged outward in the downstream direction, most forward. And those strong winds are basically what are acting as that snowplow to lift up the air violently, that warm and humid air near the surface. So once you start to see that Boeing structure, basically you're essentially halfway toward having a derecho in progress.
You may also potentially spot a derecho in progress by looking up at the sky for unusual cloud formations along the horizon.
Derechos can, but not always, be accompanied by a very well-marked shelf or arcus cloud. And basically, that it's a band of low, dark, angry-looking clouds, often showing some rotary or chaotic motions. And they represent the lowest part of the ascent that's going on the leading edge of the thunderstorm profile. So if you see a long arc of very dark, angry-looking clouds surmounted by dark but not quite as dark clouds above, and usually the sky has already taken on a very a dusky hue and maybe sometimes greenish or bluish. That dark, low roll of cloud, the shelf cloud or arcus cloud, is certainly one of the characteristics of some derechos, but unfortunately not all of them have that, and it all depends on the exact ingredients that are coming into place.
A few derechos have been documented in winter. Plus, they are not localized events, but generally involve at least several states.
But a true derecho typically extends in a more widespread fashion, maybe up to 150 or in some cases 200 miles in a much larger scale bow structure. And then within that larger scale bow, you may have smaller winds embedded within it that are surging. They represent winds that are surging forward even more rapidly than those associated with that larger scale bow. And that's where the most intense damage can occur.
Derecho damage appears differently than tornado damage.
Derecho damage, of course, typically covers a much, much broader area. And the winds, like because they're coming out of the clouds in a more or less unidirectional or in the same direction, they tend to blow things down in a straight line path. So everything is just mowed down essentially, or snow plowed down. So the trees and other debris tend to all lie in the direction from which the winds are coming.
Stephen Corfitti and his colleagues have created a derecho climatology map, concentric region of frequency. And the quad state region of Oklahoma, Missouri, Kansas, and Northwest Arkansas lie at the epicenter, with four derechos occurring every 3 years. That's because, Corfitti says, our atmosphere is fed both by the Gulf of Mexico and the southwestern Colorado Plateau.
Well, in this environment over the southern United States, and actually over a large part of the world, when severe thunderstorms are likely, you tend to have southerly winds near the ground, and then westerly winds at the mid-altitude, say 1 or 2 or 3 miles above you. And that's certainly the case over Arkansas when you're getting tornado or severe weather outbreaks.
The Storm Prediction Center publishes a detailed chronology of significant derechos. Two of note, the cross-country derecho, which occurred 2 years ago, traveled 1,300 miles over a 24-hour period from central high plains across the Great Lakes region into the mid-Atlantic states, clocking 100 miles per hour. The storm actually plowed up a seiche, a sudden swell on Lake Michigan. It was also the first time, SPC says, the word derecho was picked up and widely broadcast by media. Then there's the super derecho of 2009, cited as one of the most intense and unusual ever observed, traveling 1,000 miles from western Kansas to eastern Kentucky. It's documented as causing unprecedented continuous damage. Most recently, on July 23rd, a derecho packing 80-mile-per-hour winds was reported to have gusted over Tulsa. Here's some audio of that storm posted on YouTube. The derecho, which originated in southern Kansas, recorded the highest winds ever at Tulsa International Airport, dumped 5 inches of rain in some places, and produced baseball-sized hail. So given that our climate is warming, can we expect more frequent and intense derechos?
If indeed you warm the atmosphere, you're not just warming the surface, which of course would be a tendency, would be likely to produce more thunderstorms and possibly more derechos, but you're also warming the upper levels of the atmosphere. So if you warm the upper levels, say, more than you're warming the lower levels of the atmosphere, the atmosphere will actually become more stable. And so it may get more humid and uncomfortable down near the ground, but it won't necessarily result in more storms. So it's a complex you can't give an easy answer to that. And in addition, these changes in the thermodynamics affect the wind. So if you're warming the upper levels of the atmosphere also, you're also shifting the belt of stronger westerly winds aloft farther north. And again, that may either shift the corridor most likely to see derechos, or it may actually change it in such a way that they become less likely.
You can see for yourself how our weather is trending by bookmarking the National Weather Service Storm Prediction Center on your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. And many thanks to Stephen Corfitti, lead forecaster, for taking time on a Sunday afternoon to discuss the mysterious and destructive phenomenon known as derechos.
That was a story from earlier this year on Ozarks at Large. This week, we're talking about some of our favorite stories that we were fortunate enough to cover, or people we were fortunate enough to interview on Ozarks at Large the previous 12 months. I have a question for Christina Thomas.
Okay.
Would you jump out of a plane?
Yes.
You did?
I did jump out of a plane, yes.
Explain yourself.
Well, I was going to the Skydive Sky Ranch in Siloam Springs to do a story for an event for a nonprofit that they were hosting, Skydive for Kids, for the Child Advocacy Center of Benton County. Various people can jump out of a plane to raise money for this organization. And I was going to do a story on the event, and as I was leaving, the owner, Wolf, said, "You're scholarshiped in." I'm like, "What?" And he said, "That means free. You can come to the event and skydive for free." I wasn't really expecting that. Wolf Grolke remembers his first time to skydive.
When the door opened, my mama didn't raise me to do this. It's nuts. I'm 10,000 feet off the ground. This is crazy. But I went ahead and put my foot out anyway. And when we left the airplane, I went from this absolute total terror to absolute jubilation in about 3 seconds. And during free fall, I didn't care if parachute opened or not. That's how much fun it was.
After 29 jumps, Wolf decided he was a better pilot than a skydiver and is now the owner and operator of Skydive Sky Ranch in Siloam Springs. He has well over 13,000 hours flying skydivers and says the Sky Ranch has conducted close to 150,000 jumps in its 24 years. Now, Wolf really just enjoys watching others have fun.
Actually, it's just a blast. And the people you meet are from every walk of life. You can have an attorney and a concrete worker on the same load. And in the sky, they're just skydivers. They're not a doctor or attorney or a guy that lays bricks, it's a whole different. So you run into people from every walk of life with a common interest, and that's to have a whole lot of fun.
Beverly Engel wasn't even in the room when Wolf said that, but echoes that sentiment, saying that it seems to be on everyone's bucket list, whether a sous chef, an executive, or a law enforcement officer.
I mean, everybody, gets off and they go, "I want to do this again." I really have never seen so much exhilaration, and people just, they love it. And, it's on so many people's bucket list, and it's always so surprising to me every year to see the people who really, do this and want to do it.
Beverly is the executive director of the Child Advocacy Center of Benton County. This fourth annual Skydive for Kids event will benefit that organization. She says she got the idea for this event from similar ones conducted by CACs around the nation. Her board of directors was a little leery at first.
We have attorneys on the board. What about the liability? And, they were really concerned. And all of those things after talking with Wolf and, assured us. And, of course, there are things that people do have to sign. And no one under 18 can jump. We have so many young people who cannot wait. I mean, they are like, cannot wait till their 18th birthday so they can come jump. We've had family groups. Grandmothers, daughters, granddaughters jump, so it's been a really great event for us.
and then you recorded part of it.
I did. Well, they record it for you, actually,
yeah.
Because you can get a video.
Right.
So I borrowed the sound from that video.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is our own Christina Thomas. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Thank you for stopping by today. You had an exciting weekend. Well, a very interesting Saturday morning.
I did. I did indeed. I went skydiving.
That's pretty great.
Right. I did a story on the Child Advocacy Center of Benton County. This is their fourth annual Skydive for Kids event.
And the idea is that people raise money and then go skydive.
Right. Last year, they raised about $40,000. They don't have the numbers in this
Quite
year
because mm-hmm.
it was just this weekend.
Sure.
But yeah, they had 27 jumpers, and I was one of them.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
And you had never been skydiving before?
I never had, no.
Okay, and I understand you got some sound while you were out there?
I did. They record everything to give you a DVD, and I asked for the audio from that recording.
What are we doing today, Christina?
Skydiving!
Skydiving!
Woo!
What makes you want to do something like that?
I'm crazy!
You're crazy?
Crazy.
We're going in that plane right behind you over there. Are you ready to go have some fun?
I guess so.
You know it's dangerous, right?
That's what they say.
Yeah? How'd you get yourself into this?
I think you talked me into it.
I think so?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
So you go in the morning and you have a couple hours of training. Is that about right?
It was really just 15 minutes of training.
Okay.
There's not much to it.
I really didn't know how much it was, but you did a tandem jump, so you're with someone else. You're not by yourself, so that requires a lot less.
Right. He's doing all the work.
Right.
I just have to trust him.
And I knew you were excited going out to it, but I always wonder if it's, you know, like one of those roller coasters that somebody gets to the top, they're really excited, and then all of a sudden they're just like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. At any point were you ever nervous or questioning your decision to do this?
For sure. We were in a teeny tiny plane. And climbing up to 10,000 feet mm-hmm. took about 10 or 15 minutes.
Wow.
And so you have 10 or 15 minutes to just sort of sit there and look out the window and think about what you're getting ready to do.
And you were thinking about not doing it?
I don't think I was necessarily thinking about not doing it, but I was like, why am I doing this? And you might even be able to hear a little bit of that right here.
They pull the door back and you're ready to jump. What were you thinking at that point?
It was, again, why am I doing this? For sure. It's scary to put your foot out on like that. There's a step that you put your foot out on.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the winds, I don't even know how fast they're going, but they're going fast.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to trust your guy. And Brad Barnett, he was great. I am so glad that I was with him. He's really good at his job, for sure.
And what did it feel like falling, that far from a plane?
You kind of black out for a second, really.
Really?
It was just kind of like, and there you go. You're going 120 miles an hour before the parachute
that fast
opens.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was, it didn't really feel like it, but it was about 45 seconds of free fall before he actually opened the parachute. And I really liked the parachute. You can actually hear me say, I like the free fall, And then once the parachute opened, I was like, oh, I'm glad the parachute opened, but I kind of want to be free falling again.
That kind of nice feeling of just falling. I've always wondered if it would be hard to breathe because, on like a roller coaster when you drop, sometimes it's a little hard to catch your breath. And when you're falling that fast, I was wondering if it was the same kind of effect.
Oh, it definitely is. It definitely is.
What do you think about that?
That was crazy.
You did it.
Glad the parachute opened.
How was that range of emotions?
For the record, did anyone here try to talk you out of doing that?
I don't think so. Well, actually, you did.
Yeah, okay.
You totally did.
You
totally did.
I want University of Arkansas insurance personnel to know that I made you sign the disclaimer and I tried to talk you out of it.
Yes, yes.
Which brings me to a story that Timothy Dennis did this year that was about decision-making exactly. and the decisions people make, or in this case, cities.
Right. And I mean,
voters.
I talked to the mayor of the second, third, and fourth largest cities in Arkansas, that being Fort Smith, Fayetteville, and Springdale. And this story came about after Springdale decided to no longer provide funeral escorts. They decided it was a liability, and they received quite a bit of public backlash for it. So I started thinking, okay, this is something that cities have to deal with. How do you handle public backlash to an unpopular decision? So I spoke with Mayor Lionel Jordan, Doug Sprouse, and
Sandy Sanders.
Sandy Sanders, exactly.
From Fort Smith, yeah.
And they gave me a wide variety of responses.
That noise you hear in the background is a regular occurrence in every city and town in existence. No, it's not the prelude to church services, though some probably treat the scene with similar reverence. In a few seconds, the proceedings will get underway and Fayetteville alderpersons will deal with matters of business concerning every resident of the city. Shh, the meeting's about to begin. Of course, the business dealt with by this or any other city council or board varies from meeting to meeting. Sometimes, few items on the agenda garner lengthy debate or discussion, while other times, one or more items of business can receive an hour or more of public input, especially if a vocal segment of citizens is opposed to a proposed ordinance or resolution. But sometimes, the most vocal opposition from residents comes in the wake of decisions not made at council meetings. Such was the case when Springdale city officials decided in mid-January to stop providing police escorts for funeral processions in the city. Springdale Mayor Doug Sprouse says that that particular decision wasn't an easy one for some residents to swallow.
I think in my 4 years in office, that's been the most controversial, no doubt. I mean, we've had other, you know, had to make other tough calls, but that was probably the one that had the most negative public reaction.
He says that the decision to end the funeral escorts wasn't easily made. After both an independent efficiency study by the Matrix Consulting Group and a recommendation from Police Chief Kathy O'Kelly brought the issue to city leaders' attention, the practice of using Springdale police officers as escorts for funeral processions ended in the name of increasing traffic safety for both the city's police officers and residents.
In this particular instance, what made this so cut and dried for me is that I saw it as a safety issue. So it wasn't a political issue or a popularity contest. It was something that I decided, you know, once there was a safety issue, then that had to be paramount in the decision making. It wasn't about whether it's popular or not. So in some ways, those decisions are, I don't want to say easier, because this was a very tough decision, but there's a justification that you're confident in, you feel you've made the right decision.
And Mayor Sprouse says he was confident in his decision, so after a few days of receiving negative responses from residents, he issued a press release detailing his reasons for ending the funeral escorts in the city. But he says that negative responses are the ones city leaders are most likely to hear from residents. Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan tends to agree with that notion.
You realize you're going to get those kind of calls, but once it's settled within yourself and you have determined the path, the decision has been made and you go, okay, here's the reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing. And you know that not everybody's going to agree with you. And everybody has a right to their opinion.
And the city of Fayetteville itself is no stranger to tough decisions. In the past 5 years, there have been a handful of issues that have drawn the ire of vocal groups of local residents. Some of those decisions have included enactment of the paid parking system in the downtown area, a proposed smoking ban in all bars within the city limits, and the creation of the city's Streamside Protection Ordinance.
And the Streamside Protection Ordinance. We had over 15 hours of public comment in three meetings. So that one particular subject in that agenda was an average of 5 hours every city council meeting for three city council meetings in a row. And then from that, you hear everybody's side. And when I make decisions, I am open. I will have a plan, but I'm also open to listen.
For instance, Paid parking today isn't the same as when it was first implemented. City leaders made adjustments to the plan two or three times in the first year of implementation alone, but sometimes the conflict with implementation of a city policy arises among the city's residents. That was the situation with Fort Smith's plans to automate all trash collection in the city. City Administrator Ray Gossack says that the city decided to go automated 7 years ago. City leaders intended on phasing in the plan's implementation over a six-year period in order to manage the cost of switching from the older manual collection.
Then in the last year, there were some neighborhoods, particularly those that had some historic appeal to them, who objected to the change in how their solid waste was collected.
Not all of the neighborhoods in the final phase of implementation were opposed to the automated collection, but enough residents were against the change that they convinced the city's board of directors to halt the implementation of automated collection. But that wasn't the end of the issue. A separate group of residents who didn't want the rates charged for trash collection to increase organized a petition aimed at overturning the city board's decision. They gathered enough signatures to put the issue on the ballot, and the measure received enough votes to force the city to finish implementing the automated trash collection. Gossack says that the conflict arose from a lack of understanding on the part of some residents. He says that there is only one real way for conflict to be avoided in the face of difficult decisions.
We need to keep residents informed, and we need to keep them informed and involved as the decision is being made, not after the decision is made, because we typically, when there's a difficult decision to be made, it's not made quickly or instantaneously. And so there is time to alert the public to the issue, to provide information and facts so that they can understand and analyze the issue, and then hopefully have a better understanding of why the decision that is ultimately made was made.
And though his position isn't an elected one, Gossack says that the responsibility of city leaders is to make decisions that are in the best interests of the majority of city residents, as opposed to making decisions as agents of the public's demands.
I think that elected officials and senior city staff have a responsibility to make recommendations and decisions that are in the best interest of the greatest number of residents, and in the best interest both short-term and long-term. So, you know, many times we find ourselves balancing short-term interest as well as what's sustainable for the long-term.
Mayor Sprouse of Springdale agrees, saying that overall, city leaders must make the best choices for city residents.
But good minds can disagree on what's best for a city. That's where the difficult decisions come in. I don't mind making tough decisions if I'm confident in the decision, and I try and weigh those things. But the decisions can be very difficult to make because you are impacting the lives of other people. And sometimes you're called on to make a decision that helps one person and hurts another.
He says that the trick is for city leaders to weigh what they believe is right against the city's ordinances and resolutions to determine what is best for the majority of a city's residents. But Sprouse says that there is no universal approach to making tough decisions.
I think it depends on the situation. When you're talking about things like safety issues, you have to make the best decision for the public. You know, somebody has to make that decision, and because I'm in this position, then I've got to make that decision. In this case, it was to whether or not to support the chief's decision. But there are other times that, you know, public safety is not the issue.
As an example, Sprouse says that city leaders are currently involved in a back and forth with developers wanting to build a truck stop at the intersection of Don Tyson Parkway and Interstate 540. Though he is not opposed to the truck stop being built in the city, Mayor Sprouse says that he is opposed to its proposed location because of concern for the overall impact it would have on future development in that part of town.
Some of the public agrees with that. I hope most public does, and the council has backed me on this. But we have gotten some pushback from some residents that believe, you know, we need the sales tax revenue. We ought to invite them with open arms. So, you know, it is a combination. It depends on the issue, you know, and the importance of that issue and the weight of that issue. I mean, I always invite public input, but sometimes it matters more than others.
But Mayor Jordan says that part of the Fayetteville administration's philosophy is to accept all input from the public when making tough decisions.
Everybody should have the freedom to express themselves. Doesn't matter if I agree with it or not. I should be willing as a public servant, and that's why they call us public servants, to listen to a point of view. You see, here's the interesting thing. It's when you can sit across the table from someone that has an entirely different point of view than you do and respect them for that and give them that type of freedom to express yourself, knowing that what they're saying to me is something that I'm not in agreement, but I listen and respect them for that point of view. That's when you're getting somewhere.
He says that it is part of the job to listen to input from all sides of an issue.
As a mayor, you're sort of a facilitator. You bring everybody together and you try to come up with something that everybody, you're not going to please everybody, but the majority of the public can agree upon.
That's a story that aired earlier this year on Ozarks at Large. This is a special edition of Ozarks, as are all of our daily shows this week. Some of our favorite stories that we did in 2013. Antoinette Grajeda one day discovered the Wienermobile. Well, you didn't discover
it. I think you're the one that got a press release that it was coming to town, because I think they typically come through the area about once a year or so. And so I just decided to go take a trip over there and talk to a couple of the girls that were driving it. And I found out that there is more than one. There's actually a fleet of them that go around the country, and they have two people on them. And it's an internship for these kids to kind of learn PR skills and stuff like that. But it was just really fun to kind of go out there and see that there's more to it than just, you know, kids coming up and checking out the Wienermobile. But I got to go inside and check it out, and it was just a lot of fun.
What are you doing?
No.
Do you like a wiener whistle, sir?
I would. Yeah. I wish I had my granddaughter.
I know. Is this not adorable?
We have the door open if you
want to
peek inside, too.
Y'all have fun.
Thank you.
My hot dogger name is Hot Diggity Holly. My actual name is Holly Nelson. And as I said before, I'm an Oscar Mayer hot dogger. And the full-length title is Oscar Mayer Wienermobile Brand Ambassador. You know, every week varies, which is what's awesome, is being a hot dogger is so dynamic. Every week we have different events. Sometimes we're going to festivals, sometimes golf tournaments. We just had a team earlier this year that was down on the field at the Atlanta Falcons game. So it always changes. Normally, though, we also, at events, we set up a table, people come, we have wiener whistles, we have fun activities with families, they can see inside the Wienermobile. And of course, we also do the behind-the-scenes kind of stuff, too. So we do the media pitching, press releases, negotiations, and the maintenance of the vehicle. So last week, we had to wash the Wienermobile, Lisa and I. So it's no easy feat, let me tell you. I did work at a public radio station. My senior year of college, I was a marketing coordinator up in Duluth, Minnesota. I'm originally from La Crosse, Wisconsin, but I went to school at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. So that they were right on campus, and it was a really awesome experience that actually helped me get this position. I would love to do marketing and event coordination for some type of organization. I don't know what yet, but we're working on that. Probably work for an agency next year. I really want to move to Chicago, but we'll see.
All right. Step over that one. All right, so in the Wienermobile here, let me just shut this up. We have in the very front, as you can see, what we refer to as the bun box. So we just store various things in here, CDs, anything else like that. Up here, you can see the bun roof, AKA the sunroof. We usually have someone sit on top if we're doing like a parade or if we need to, you know, air it out. And of course, safety first, so we have our meat belts. And you can see our really cute seats here. They have the little embroidered Wienermobiles all over. We don't want you to forget that you are in the Wienermobile. If you look on the floor here, we have our ketchup floor with our mustard stain. Looks like somebody spilled a little. Of course, in the ceiling, we also have Always Sunny Skies in the Wienermobile. And then in the very far back, a lot of people wonder what it is, if it's a bathroom or where we sleep. It's no Wienibago. We don't sleep in here. We stay in hotels. That's just our closet. So we store our luggage and other promotional materials in there. The Wienermobile is 27 feet long, AKA 60 hot dogs long. It is 8 feet wide and 11 feet high. The Wienermobile itself has been around since 1936.
But this is the 2012 model you're in. So there's been multiple versions, and this is actually just the most recent one, so that's pretty exciting. We're driving Big Bun. They all have different names. So Big Bun mostly resides in the southeast. Right now we're sort of in the Mid-South team's territory here in the Bentonville area. But yeah, we mostly reside down near Florida and Georgia. Just to spread miles of smiles, we like to say, you know, everybody loves seeing the Wienermobile. You know, I mean, I always like to say I'm never going to have a job where people are more excited to see me. You know, because everywhere you go, I mean, you're pumping gas, you're at the grocery store, you're going to see a movie, everyone is so happy. And I think that that's what's really neat, is that we're creating memories for people of all ages, really. You know, kids, if it's their first time, or if it's an adult and they haven't seen it since they were a kid. You know, it's really cool to see that magic happen and give them another wiener whistle, or their first wiener whistle. That's a really neat opportunity that I'm so happy I have here with my hot dogger position with Oscar Mayer.
The Wienermobile in Northwest Arkansas earlier this year. For some reason, that makes me think of silly questions. Not that you had silly questions.
No.
But I had some silly questions for Frank Tavares earlier this year. He is kind of being phased out as being the voice of NPR's underwriters, which is fine with him. He's kind of going to semi-retirement. He's still a college professor, and he doesn't live in Washington, D.C. He lives in Connecticut, so they have hired someone else to be the voice. But when I talked to him about his short stories, I did ask him a few silly questions about being the voice for so long, for decades of NPR's underwriting. Well, here is silly question number one.
Yeah.
Have you ever gone up to a counter and asked someone if they sold forever stamps?
You caught me in the middle of drinking water. That was very dangerous. But no, and I'm going to now.
You got to be careful, because that could really mess with somebody, though.
Oh, yes. But I've had people who know me, some of my colleagues at the university, will come by me. I've had this happen to me, I think, on three different occasions. Now, you know they're NPR listeners, because somebody will come up to me. I had somebody do this in a meeting with our new dean, as a matter of fact. We're all there, and the meeting hasn't started. And somebody just leaned over to me, behind me, so I didn't see who it was, and they did the line. Mentioned one of the pharmacies sells forever stamps at the checkout counter. And I'm thinking, they're listening.
All right.
Nicely done, Kyle.
Thank you. Silly question number two.
Yeah.
Have people recognized you because of the Capital Cities song that might not have heard you on NPR?
Not yet, but I'm waiting for it. And now we're going to have to tell people. Now we're going to have to tell people about the Capital Cities song.
How did that come about?
The fellows in the group, Capital Cities is a Los Angeles music group, and I got an email from one of them back in the very early spring, or it might have been from their agent, who said basically that they're working on this particular piece and they're trying this little funny idea, and they wonder if I might be open to voicing a couple of pieces of it for them. Well, you're always suspicious when somebody approaches you, because I mean, if somebody tracks me down and asks me if I'd be willing to work on something, I'm very careful about it. There's nothing in my contract with NPR about the work I do with NPR, for instance, that prohibits me from doing other voice work. But because I've been involved with NPR, both part-time and full-time, I was a department head there for a decade, executive producer. I was host of several non-news shows during my tenure there. I'm one of these real passionate public radio fans, and I'm going to be very careful about doing anything that might reflect negatively on my association with NPR and on public radio. So, you know, I'm very leery at first, and they said, well, let us send you a clip of this, and then they voiced some of it. One of the guys in the band voiced what they wanted me to do using different words, and then they pulled a clip of me doing a funding credit someplace and put it in so I could hear how it went against the music. So long story short, I thought, you know, this is going to be fun. And it reminded me, do you remember the Meatloaf song from years ago, Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
With Phil Rizzuto doing the play-by-play.
With Phil Rizzuto doing that little cameo where he does the play-by-play as the characters in the song are basically making out in the front seat of this car. And it put me in mind of that. Well, here's this, one of the artists on this particular CD clip. Did you ever think, Kyle, that you might hear in the same sentence the names NPR's Frank Tavares and hip-hop artist Andre 3000 together? I mean, that's just...
Support for Capital Cities comes from Lazy Hooks. Public Radio.
Silly question number three. Have you ever visited the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation?
I'm really enjoying your silly questions, Kyle. This is really cool. No, I haven't, but I remember when we used to have quite a few credits from Ted and Jennifer Stanley years ago, and then Jennifer Stanley was on the board of directors for NPR for a while, and I was still there when she was on the board. We overlapped, I think, from my full-time association with them, and I did have a chance to meet her a few times, and I remember telling her that aside from her, I was the one that said her name out loud more than anybody else.
That was Frank Tavares, who for decades has been the voice of NPR's underwriting announcements, an interview that aired earlier this fall on Ozarks at Large. It's a special edition of Ozarks when we talk about some of our favorite things, favorite people, favorite places we've covered in 2013. Katie, you went to 21C when they brought in their second ever temporary exhibit.
Yes, Alice Gray Stites, who's the chief curator for all of the 21C hotels, there's three of them, came in to talk about the new Cuban exhibit. And for one, I grew up in this area, and it's just amazing to me I can go not so far away and go to a contemporary art museum like that. So that's really amazing. And then, two, her mission statement, she has a very unique mission statement in that art is a verb. So she wants people to talk about what art is doing and not just talk about what it's about. So I really enjoyed talking to her about the new exhibit. Alice Gray Stites, Chief Curator and Director of Art Programming for 21C, is in town to talk about the new exhibit.
The artistic visions that are presented here reflect the evolution of competing ideologies. After the demise of the Marxist revolution led by Castro, the promise of a kind of socialist utopia has faded, and the development of greater commerce, what is the promise of capitalism versus the Marxist utopia that has now passed, and then, of course, the continuing other belief systems like religion.
In addition to those themes, Stites also explains how the landscape and urban architecture reflects what is happening in Cuba today, socially, politically, and environmentally.
A number of the installations illustrate or reflect on how the buildings in Cuba, the beautiful colonial buildings of the past, are decaying alongside those that were built in the 60s and 70s when Cuba was getting a lot of financial support from what was then the Soviet Union. As those resources disappeared in the wake of the breakup of the Soviet Union, buildings that were intended to be for the future have begun decaying alongside the past. So time, the disjunctions of time, the past decaying along with what was to be the future in this present, is another theme in the exhibition. What artists are doing and what many Cubans are doing in their day-to-day lives are being ingenious in creating a new future for their city and their nation.
The media might be diverse, as is the message, but one piece informs the other. Everything seems intertwined.
And sometimes seemingly in opposition to one another. Again, that sense of paradox is really prevalent and rich, and it allows us to see what a layered and complex culture is, what in Cuba and how fascinating and how much they're adding to the art world far beyond their own shores. Some of them may be isolated, but their artwork is reaching out and connecting all over the world.
In 2010, Alice Gray Stites gave a TEDx U.S. Embassy Stockholm talk called Art is a Verb. In the introduction, she says art is too important and too essential to all of our well-being to be relegated to the nebulous security of the passive. We need to talk about what art does and what art is, not what art says or what it represents. And 21C Bentonville is a perfect example of this philosophy.
Contemporary artists are not making work that simply adds an aesthetic layer that entertains or decorates, although those are wonderful things that add to our lives and our culture as well. But many of them are creating works that solve real-world problems, that address important issues. We're looking here at a commissioned project for 21C Bentonville. This is the Tree of 40 Fruit by artist Sam Van Aken. So Van Aken is a multimedia artist and now, I guess, an arborist based in Syracuse. And what he has done is to graft 40 different kinds of stone fruit trees. Now, many of these are what I think it's fashionable now to call heirloom species. But in fact, these are species of trees, hybrid species that otherwise would no longer exist. So these are species that are dying off, some of them because of environmental conditions, because they are not growing anymore. And Sam has started this whole process where he creates these beautiful trees where the fruits will continue to grow and to blossom. That's doing something.
Another example of art doing something is Dan Rosegard's Flow, a site-specific permanent installation at 21C Bentonville.
He, like many contemporary artists, is not simply an artist. He's an engineer, an architect, a designer, as well as a visual artist. In fact, he just won what's known as the Oscars of the design world, the Index Award, that's given to design that makes a difference in the world. So what he's done here, Flow, is actually a smart wall of ventilators, and there are sensors embedded in it that when they pick up on both sound and movement, begin to spin, releasing air into this space. So what this work does is it activates the architecture surrounding it, the space that you're in, makes you aware of the natural world. You feel wind on your face. And of course, interacting with the piece brings people together. So this is social sculpture as much as it is a beautiful work of art that casts this lovely kind of Islamic pattern of shadows on the wall behind it. Contemporary art engages all of our senses, connects people to each other, to themselves, to the world immediately around you, and like many of the works in the Cuban show, takes you far beyond.
This philosophy on contemporary art fits perfectly with the philosophy of 21C, where you experience art while part of your daily activities.
Contemporary art is about lived experience, and what better way to engage with it than by experience it directly as part of your daily activities.
That was recorded at 21C, and that exhibit is still up.
Yes.
You can still see that. They do
Absolutely.
6 months at a time, basically, for the traveling exhibits. A lot of people travel, a lot of things travel into Northwest Arkansas. We have a chance to talk to some of them. Dave Berry, the Pulitzer Prize winner, spoke at the Fayetteville Public Library this year, and we had a chance before his visit to talk to him. You know, I think back to Big Trouble, which was your first novel intended for an adult audience, and you have Puggy, who is the sort of homeless drifter who lives in a tree. You seem to have a soft spot for underdogs.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think most books, if you're going to get people to want it, to root for your characters, to care about them, you have to make them, you know, less than perfect. They have to face obstacles. They have to deal with problems and overcome challenges. Otherwise, really, what's the story? If it's just, you know, this perfect person has a perfect day, there isn't really much of interest in that. You know, which is why people read. It's why people watch TV. Why people watch Downton Abbey? You know, because they know that in every episode, problems are going to arise, and these characters they've come to know will have to deal with them, and how will they deal with them? And so, sort of the essence of of keeping the story interesting to people is to put problems in people's paths. And it's good to have an underdog, I think, anyway, as your protagonist, because that's where people's sympathies lie, and that's what they identify with.
Should point out that Insane City has a lower body count than Downton Abbey.
Yeah, that's true. Nobody dies in my book. In fact, there really isn't that much violence. There's some threats of violence, and there's some people who are not that wonderful. But it isn't one of those books where, like, the bad guy is shooting everybody.
No. It's funny, in the foreword to Big Trouble, which is when you launched this part of your career with these kinds of novels, you point out, you know, younger readers should stop now because you've done so many books. And you said, because you have some characters who use adult language, you as the writer didn't want them to, but as characters they did. I've heard other writers talk about sometimes characters doing things they didn't expect. Does that actually happen?
Yeah, the first person to tell me that was one of my heroes, Elmore Leonard. And I got to know him, and one night I ended up in this long conversation about, you know, writing characters, and he was saying that, you know, you will not necessarily know, and you'll see this in his books, you'll not necessarily know when you're writing the first chapter or two which of these characters is really going to be important and which one is just going to disappear. And you'll also not really know what they're going to do. You think you do, but sometimes they take on, you know, once you started writing them, you feel as though you're more channeling them. And they do things you don't expect them to do. One of the characters in this book, her name is Cindy. When I started writing the book, in my mind, she was a minor character. And she ends up being a major character, kind of because of the way she acted.
Right.
Which I know sounds weird, because obviously I'm writing the words she's saying. I'm writing what she does. But, you know, you sort of have this image in your mind of this person. What would that person do? And the person sort of tells you, well, I would do this. I would say that.
Dave Barry, earlier this year on Ozarks at Large, a special edition of Ozarks at Large, some of our favorite stories and interviews. We'll do this again tomorrow. In a moment, music from Joe Crookston, who was another one of our guests on the live edition of Ozarks at Large, the Roots Festival, and really kind of surprised. I mean, we knew Iris DeMent would wow people. We knew that Del McCrory band would wow people. Not many of us knew Joe Crookston.
No, but everybody knew him by the time we were done, because he ended up playing actually two sets, bless his heart, because the final musician we had some sort of scheduling conflict and didn't show up. And so I sort of volunteered him to play another song.
Well, he jumped up.
He was very pleased to do.
He had people crying.
He did.
In a good way.
Yes, in a good way, yes.
But no, I apologized to him profusely the rest of the weekend and promised him beer.
Well, he, did you deliver on that?
I mean, I pointed him to the,
to the bar.
Well, there was a giant, I mean, right. I figured better than me buying him a beer was the giant cake they had in the green room at the Walnut Center.
Yes.
So I pointed him in that direction, because apparently he had not been informed.
Well, so you helped out.
I helped out.
My baby girl was born in 1943, year before the Navy shipped me out and overseas. So I held her and kissed her, and I said my goodbye, leaving Virginia. Beneath the blistering sun on Tinian Island, there was work to be done. 4,000 Navy Seabees on the ground, crushing up coral, packing it down, crushing and packing it down. Work like hell till the work gets done. We built four lines. Charlie and Dog. Abel Baker, Charlie and
Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. Thanks so much for listening. More favorites tomorrow.